History Babes would like to say thank you to their sponsors. First of all, the Baker Street Journal, which continues to be the leading Sherlockian publication since its founding in 1986 by Edgar W. Smith. With both serious scholarship and articles that play the game, the journal is essential reading for anyone interested in Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and the world where it is always 1895. Go to www.bakerstreetjournal.com to find out more. We'd also like to say thank you to West Express, who are the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Whether you've just discovered the great detective or you're a seasoned Sherlockian, we're sure you'll find many unique volumes to pique your interest. Go to www.westexpress.com and have a browse. And last but not least, we'd like to say thank you to the Scintillation of Science, which is an annual symposium of fans of Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, which is sponsored by Watson's Tin Box in Maryland, USA. A Scintillation of Science number 6 is going to take place June 7 to 9, 2013 in Hanover, Maryland, and registration is now open. Go to www.scintillation.org. What you're about to listen to is an interview with Roger Johnson and Jean Upton from the Sherlock Holmes Society of London. They invited Kathleen Curley and myself to their house to have a bit of a chat, which we did. We spent a pleasant evening with them. I certainly had fun. Kathleen and Curley had fun. And I hope you lovely listeners have fun too when you listen to it. And we'd like to say thank you very much to Roger and Jean for having us.
They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. This quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one be mine?
I got into the world of Sherlockiana by a slightly odd route.
I think this is a good time to, like, lead in with the questions.
Yeah, he's already answering the question I haven't even asked, is how you got into Sherlock Holmes, so continue.
Okay, well, how I got into Sherlock Holmes is another matter. I started reading the books, period.
Yeah.
But getting into the wider Sherlockian world, I was and am something of a devotee of H.P. Lovecraft. And
his
And when I was, 17 or thereabouts, I discovered that there was a European agent, no less, of Arkham House, the publishers that August Derleth set up, originally just to publish Lovecraft stories in book form. And I started buying books. I actually had them delivered to my school because I had the feeling that my parents were, what are you spending all this money on?
Oh, yeah, no, H.P. Lovecraft is a bit intense.
Well, they didn't mind the subject. It was just the fact that I was spending money on books. They were comparatively expensive. But through that, I discovered that Derleth had written a whole series of Sherlock Holmes influenced stories. They weren't about Holmes, they were about Solar Ponds, the Sherlock Holmes of Praed Street. They're well worth reading.
Oh.
It's the only really substantial series about a Holmes imitator, if you like. The first volume had a very enthusiastic introduction by Vincent Starrett. And subsequent ones, Ellery Queen and Edgar W. Smith and other, Michael Harrison and other people said, yeah, this is jolly good, and so it is. Through reading the stories, and I discovered that there was actually a Praed Street Irregulars, which was founded by a guy out in Culver City, California, Luther L. Norris. I wrote to Luther and got a response investing me in the Praed Street Irregulars. Wow, God, this is quick.
Nice.
Luther, God bless him, I think was probably the best friend that I never met. Mm. We should have met in London round about 1970 when he and his wife were on a European tour. But she died in Rome.
Oh, my God. Oh.
Shortly before they were due to come on to London.
Oh,
and, of course, he went straight back to California, so we never did meet. But it was Luther who requested several leading Sherlockian scholars to contact me, and they were John Bennett Shaw, Peter Blau, Ted Schultz, and John Lellenberg, also Michael Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
So from the start, my contacts with the greater Sherlockian world had been American as much as British. And yeah, I've been very lucky there.
Mm.
he said, looking at his American Sherlockian wife.
Very lucky.
Do you think that every day?
Oh,
correct answer.
Me and the cats both.
No. How did you two meet, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, I had joined the Sherlock Holmes Society of London in the 1980s, and then I used to come over each year because, see, the first trip I made was in 87. When the Society was invited up to Manchester to Granada Studios.
Oh, cool.
And both of us were there. We both appeared in a photograph together, but we never met.
Well, she says together, there is actually one person standing between us.
Tony Howlett.
Bless
whom
him.
You have
Mike Croftian.
No. Yeah.
He was a
big lad.
A dear friend.
Yes.
But, for one reason and another, during that whole day, we never actually met, even though we had corresponded.
Yeah. So, as I say, I started coming over each year for the extended weekends that the Society was doing, going visiting different places mm-hmm. where the stories took place. And then it was in 1989 at Cambridge that Roger and I finally met. And then I decided to go on the 1991 trip to Switzerland, which was over 8 days.
Right.
So it's not quite as frantic, because at the weekends you're running around trying to say hello to 100 different people.
Exactly,
and that's
yeah.
about as much as you get to say in
yeah.
that short time. So it was a bit more of a relaxed experience mm-hmm. in Switzerland. And then we got married the following year.
Wow.
There you go.
And Jean Conan Doyle.
Was
Sir Arthur's daughter was a guest at our wedding.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Aww. That's really good.
Yeah, because I had gotten to know her as well.
This is a woman that cockles in my heart.
That's
just
the line,
proves
talking.
There is someone for everybody.
That's what my mum always says.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, we were married at the United Reformed Church in Chelmsford, and the minister incorporated the fact that we were Sherlockians into his address during the service.
No, he didn't know he was going to.
And one of our guests, Anna Smith,
yeah.
who is still a member of the Sherlock Holmes Society, said to the person sitting next to her, "Who is that man? I want to run away with him."
Brilliant.
So how did you get into Sherlock Holmes?
Oh, I started quite young. When I was little, I seemed to be catching every known childhood disease
mm-hmm.
and was basically confined to my room for quite a long time. And I already was reading at a fairly advanced stage.
Right.
And went through all the books in the house and finally settled on Sherlock Holmes. And I was 6 at the time.
Wow.
Yeah.
But I had known Sherlock Holmes. I think I must have seen some of the Basil Rathbone films on television.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think Warner Brothers had done cartoons incorporating Sherlock mm-hmm. Holmes. So I knew a bit about the character. And I just started digging into them. And I still have the book upstairs
Aww.
With the little pencil check marks against each of the stories.
Oh, wow.
Oh, nice.
Sweet.
Yeah. And gradually got more and more interested in Sherlock Holmes, unfortunately married someone in the 1970s who didn't share the interest, and I came home one day and discovered he'd thrown out all my Sherlock Holmes books.
Oh, no!
Sacrilege.
Mm. Well, I knew a divorce was in the and in fact, I used some of Holmes's methods to gain information that I needed in order to get him to agree to the divorce. Divorce laws are different from state to state.
Yes, so ridiculous.
And in Pennsylvania, at the time, both parties had to agree to divorce, and he wouldn't agree. He had an easy life. He hadn't worked for 2 years. I was supporting the two of us, and meanwhile, during the day, he was out taking my money and entertaining other women.
Oh, how charming.
But he wasn't terribly bright. That was how I caught him.
Yeah.
Yes. It's probably one of the reasons why he wanted to get rid of the Sherlock Holmes books. Not give me any idea. But anyway, I didn't really hook up with other Sherlockians until the 1980s. And I got involved
Sherlock Holmes
with some of
Network.
Well, there were several Sherlockian societies in the Philadelphia area where I was living. Mm-hmm. And I also joined up with the London Society at about the same time. And there's just loads of activity in the United States. I was traveling all over the place at one stage.
It does seem that there's a lot more, like, Sherlockian societies in the States than there are.
Oh, there are.
Yes. Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
On the wrong side of the Atlantic, eh?
Yeah. Yes and no. The point is, I think that Britain, and I'm thinking only at the moment of Britain, is so much smaller an area.
It is, yeah.
We can easily come together and meet people.
I used to come from Manchester when I was doing my postgrad down to London for meetings of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London. Go back the same night.
Yeah, you can do that. Yeah.
It's like a short drive in America is like 5 hours.
Yes. Yes.
A short drive in this country is like about an hour.
Yeah. Someone, I think rather brilliantly, it was an American person, actually brilliantly defined the difference. In the United States, they think 100 years is a long time ago.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And 100
in
miles.
In Britain, they think 100 miles is a long distance to travel.
Yeah, I remember
well,
that.
But the road system in the United States is better, and it's just easier to get from place to place.
We had a sort of engagement party just before Christmas, 1991, at Jean's mother's house at, just outside Philadelphia, Wincote, Pennsylvania. And rather, to my absolute astonishment, that was where I was presented with my irregular shilling.
Well, it was rather neat because the house where I lived and grew up had been inhabited by Christopher Morley for a couple of years.
Right about 1910.
It was just before the First World War.
This is quite an old house.
Yeah. So it was rather neat for him to be invested in Christopher Morley's house.
I think that's unique.
Yeah.
Jean had invited Tom Stix.
Who was Wiggins at the time.
Okay.
He and Dorothy, his wife, weren't able to make it, but they invited us for dinner at their place at
Norwood,
New Jersey. And so, what was it, 2 nights later?
Yeah.
Jean drove us up to Norwood, New Jersey. It was a white-knuckle ride. nothing to do with Jean's driving. It was the roads.
Next question. What's your favorite story from the canon?
I like the blue carbuncle.
Yes!
That's Bobby's favorite.
Well, it's not actually because every week I have like a different favorite, but it's like December
your
now.
Your current favorite.
And also Les Klinger said it was his favorite, and so I'm always like, yeah, it has a very special place in my heart, and I usually watch the Granada adaptation on Christmas.
But it's almost like a French farce. With all the various coincidences that take place.
Yeah. It's very silly. But I think maybe that's what you need in a good Christmas story.
Yeah.
I love the Blue Carbuncle, but my absolute favourite story has got to be the Bruce Partington Plans. It's just got everything in there. It's the only thing missing is Mrs. Hudson. It's got the brilliant opening at 221B over breakfast. It's got Mycroft, Lestrade, Espionage, Fog, the London Underground.
Oh, brilliant.
And Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson at the peak of their form.
Yeah.
I love it.
So, who's your favourite character then? Any character from the canon.
Oh, my goodness.
Any of them. Pick your favourite child.
And this will be forever recorded.
This, is a tough one. Yeah. I have impersonated Dr. Watson. I played Mycroft, actually, in sound only. And, I mean, I may be built more or less like Mycroft, but I'm too small height-wise. I played Lestrade.
It's hard.
It is hard.
I mean, the obvious is Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah. The one you'd want, the one I would want to meet, to be with, to chat with, is Watson.
Ooh.
Watson's the sociable one. Watson's the one you could share a drink, a meal, and a chat
with.
Yeah.
You're a unanimous agreement there.
Yeah, the next question was, who would you want to have tea with? So that kind of answers
that.
So, but then your favourite adaptation of the stories?
Oh, goodness me.
Different ones for different reasons,
yes.
Really.
I think the best screen adaptation, at any rate, of any of the canonical stories is probably The Granada Sign of Four, but only by a very, very, very narrow margin. And that's excluding all those wonderful radio adaptations for some reason, you know, for whatever reason, really. And there have been so many. So many brilliant ones.
We've not really talked about those in the podcast.
No, we haven't. It doesn't make much sense.
Just get on that.
Bert Cools, when he did, I mean, first of all, it was the Hound of the Baskervilles in a dramatization with Roger Rees and Crawford Logan as Holmes and Watson was good, very good in fact, but there was the slight problem that Holmes and Watson sounded rather alike. When Bert proposed to the BBC radio drama people that there should be a series, they said, yeah, okay, but let's have a different Holmes and Watson. So they kicked off with Study in Scarlet with Clive Merrison and Michael William, a wonderful pairing as Holmes and Watson. And then The Sign of Four, because for some reason the producers didn't trust Bert with the entire series. They got other writers in. And thank God the other writers took their cue from Bert's own style.
Mm.
And they did the entire canon.
It's the only complete canon.
To this day, it is the only
monumental achievement. Mm-hmm. It's a brilliant, wonderful achievement. I so admire Bert Cools for his ability, his willingness to let the audience do some of the work. I'll give you an example. In Study in Scarlet, when Holmes and Watson meet, Holmes wants to demonstrate his Sherlock Holmes test for blood. You remember that?
Yeah, Holmes method.
Yeah.
Exactly. And to do that, he needs a drop of blood. And he takes a bodkin, digs it into his finger, gets a couple of drops into the water. Now, as far as I remember, Michael Hardwick, who did an excellent adaptation for radio, Carlton Hobbs and Norman Shelley, it ran something like Watson saying, and so saying, he took a sharp bodkin, dug it into his finger and squeezed out a couple of drops of blood. Dixon Carr would have had Holmes say, now, I take this sharp bodkin and dig it into my finger, so, and squeeze out some blood. It was not quite this gun that I am holding in my right hand is loaded, but it was getting that way. Bert Cools had Holmes simply saying, let's have some blood. And you knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
Burtkools has to be the most sound-oriented of all the radio dramatists I've encountered. He's the one who knows what will come across to the audience.
It's that sort of getting your brain to trick you, isn't it? That thing about radio is you have to forget
the pictures
of
radio.
I've tried to follow his example in the scripts that I've written and or edited. He's amazing.
If any of our listeners are on Spotify or Deezer, if you look up Clive Merrison, most of those radio shows are on there. So if you want to have a listen, it's totally worth it.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, definitely.
Lead by his example, Gavin.
Yeah.
How about you, Jean? Do you have a different adaptation favorite or anything?
Oh, gosh.
From all the ones to choose from.
I think one always has a soft spot for one's first Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
Mine is Watson, obviously. The Granada series, at its best, was excellent. And I always liked the film The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes.
I love that film. Mm. It's a good film.
Yeah.
That's very good.
Mark Gatiss's favourite.
Mm.
The best thing was watching it with Mark Gatiss.
Yeah.
Laugh.
The whole so film. So envy.
It was so good.
It was so much
made
fun.
It worth it. What? Didn't you know about that?
No!
We went to see A Private Life with Mark Gatiss and like a bunch of people.
Yeah, this was ages ago.
This was like ages ago.
I was
going to
say, when was that?
Yeah. We went
there with Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat. Mm.
But look, you could just hear, like, we were sat right near the front and you could just hear Mark Gatiss laughing through the whole film. Mm. And it was brilliant. It added like an atmosphere to it.
Yeah,
he laughed at every joke.
Well, I introduced a showing of The Private Life. When was it? About a year ago? I can't remember. At Stratford.
Oh, that's right.
Stratford East.
Mm. Yeah, oh, okay.
It's now one of my favourite adaptations.
It's really beautiful.
Mm. It is. I mean, that is a very good word. It is a beautiful film.
It is, yeah.
And it's so funny.
It has so much, like, heart to it as well.
Yeah.
Like the way that the way they explore like the relationships that Sherlock Holmes has through the whole thing, and the ending's quite sad.
Mm.
It's very good. I like it.
Well, Billy Wilder said that perhaps he came to scoff at the shrine, but stayed to worship.
There's lots of it that ended up on the cutting room floor, actually.
It
would have been like twice the length if they had used everything.
Yeah.
Mm.
You will read in some sources that Billy Wilder refused to talk about the film because it had been so cut about.
I guess publicly, but when I was living in Los Angeles, my boss had given a party one night, I guess in 1980 this would have been, and a lot of Hollywood people were invited there. He was associated with the American Society of Cinematographers.
Okay.
And I had helped run the party for him and went and sat down next to this little old guy who turned out to be Billy Wilder.
Aww.
And I mentioned to him how much I had enjoyed the film. And he was off like a shot telling me about how frustrated he was. It would have been so much better if they'd left it alone, this, that, and the other. And, of course, I was about 25 years old at the time and didn't really understand the significance of this conversation.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I would have written down some notes at the end of the evening. Yeah, but he went on for quite a while because he had really put his heart and soul into this film. Mm. And as far as he was concerned, it was butchered.
Because they took so much out.
They took so much out of it.
Some of the audio survives, we know that. Like,
yes.
Some of the audio,
and there's
some
stills
of the video.
As well. Yeah. Yeah.
If you get the American DVD,
it has it all in the extras, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That was quite good.
I don't know why it wasn't included on the British DVD, but on the American one.
We really like extras. Maybe that's the very American thing. Because there's always like deleted scenes and all sorts of stuff on American movies.
You've got the surviving video of one sequence with subtitles, I think, if I remember rightly, for the dialogue. The surviving audio for the other deleted sequence with stills.
Oh, so you can see what's going on.
Yes. Storyboard. So, what do you think about, because young Sherlock Holmes is being remade.
Allegedly.
Is it really? Is it alleged
or is it confirmed?
I think it's fairly confirmed.
Yeah.
Why?
Because it's older than 10 years.
It's not merely more than 10 years. I mean, it's
quite a while.
25
years. Yeah.
Well,
I was born in 1985, so...
Yeah.
I was astonished. I'm sorry, this has nothing to do with young Sherlock Holmes, but I was slightly astonished recently to realise that, okay, when Hammer made The Hound of the Baskervilles in 1959, it was 23 years since the last cinema Sherlock Holmes film was made, and that was nothing. 23 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed a hell of a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the time, I mean, to me, obviously, because I wasn't born till
1948.
Yeah.
He's very old.
I'm very old. But people still think of it as a very long time, but in cinema terms.
No.
You know, it's not between one film and another, 23 years, it's not a great long.
Well, they've started doing remakes more and more nowadays.
Mm-hmm. So running out of their own original ideas. Yeah.
The guy they've got lined up, also, I understand, for the remake of Young Sherlock Holmes, his surname is Spiliotopoulos.
Wow.
I forget. Evan Spiliotopoulos. So he's obviously half Greek and half Welsh.
I don't know. IMDb that later.
Yeah,
but
don't they have Chris Columbus on board, too?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, Chris Columbus is down as producer.
Yeah,
okay.
But Evan Spiliotopoulos has made his reputation, basically, writing straight-to-video sequels.
Oh, dear.
Not good. Not good.
Bit not good.
Well, I don't know, because I haven't seen any of these straight-to-video sequels, so I can't...
Some of them, like, as a connoisseur of terrible movies, some of them are not that bad.
For example?
I watched some really good Disney movies with my sister recently.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was called Monte Carlo.
Oh, God. I would hope that they'd cast British kids.
Yeah. That would be nice.
Well, I mean, obviously, when they first proposed to do Harry Potter, they wanted to do it as like an American.
Yes.
Film. Yeah. Steven Spielberg offered to do it, and J.K. Rowling was like, "No."
Yeah, he wanted to do it Pixar, didn't he? Mm. Animated.
I think it would have made an excellent TV series, but that's just my opinion. A British TV series, a bit like Downton Abbey.
It would take forever to do all of
that. I know, it'd been great. Yeah. 7 series, it'd have been amazing. Could have done all the like every nuance of the books could have been covered. I still maintain that would have been, even if it had been in like an animated TV series, it would have been amazing. it'd have been like
Artie's like dying.
All the boarding school stories ever, but done with magic. It would have been amazing.
Have you actually seen Young Sherlock Holmes?
No, I keep meaning to.
Because if you've seen Harry Potter and then you watch Young Sherlock Holmes, it is the weirdest thing to watch.
Really?
Just in visual terms. And I think we looked it up because we did the watch along on the SH Watch Alongs community like ages ago. But I think whoever was involved in the first Harry Potter film was also involved in Young Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, it's Christopher Columbus.
Yeah, and that's why visually it is very similar.
Oh, right. Like this whole, how weird.
Like, you just go on Google Images and look up the actor who plays Watson.
He's the most adorable little boy with giant glasses.
Harry Potter! He's Harry Potter! In 1985, before it was even conceptualised.
Yes, like. No, I mean, visually, you just look at the visual style and it's so similar.
Actually, I just like to reiterate that I was born in 1985.
And I was born in 1982, so, you know.
1987!
Not that much terribly older than you.
No, true. But it was. I do watch a lot of those kind of films because, you know, it's good to backtrack and see, like, how cinematography has progressed. Because sometimes...
see what things were like in the olden days.
Sometimes they are better. Like, sometimes the stories they tell and the way they tell them is better.
There's a reason why Metropolis is still fucking around.
Yeah, because it is good. It's really good.
Friend,
Rear Window.
Metropolis, wonderful film. Yeah. Amazing film.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
One of ours.
Nosferatu.
Yes.
Yeah.
So no Justin Bieber then for Sherlock Holmes?
Oh, please no.
Would you have like the fan cast for young Sherlock Holmes or like a dream cast?
I can't even think of like young British actors.
Because the only person who comes to mind is like Andrew Garfield for me, but he's a bit old.
He's old. Also
Spider-Man. I can't even place him.
He's Spider-Man. He's
well, Spider-Man. Yeah, sorry, I'm a bit behind.
Yeah, he's half British at least.
Fine, no problem.
He's been in British films.
Yeah, yeah, like, I don't know any British kid actors.
No.
Not recently. Because the last one is like Freddie Heimer, but he's grown up.
Mm. It's funny, you know, sorry, getting off onto a slightly different track here. Robert Downey Jr. The only adverse comments I have come across about his accent as Sherlock Holmes have been from American reviewers.
Huh.
I think he's absolutely fine.
Does he sound properly British?
He does. To me, certainly.
I guess it's because I know he's American that I know he's faking it.
Mm. Well, for me, it's like I can see he's faking it, but I don't really care.
What do you think, Catherine? Robert Downey Jr.'s accent?
It skips around a little bit.
Yeah.
It's not bad, though. Like, I remember watching the film for the first time and I wasn't ever, like, you know, thrown out of it by his accent.
Yeah,
like,
that's, you know, the thing.
It's usually like, it's like if you watch Pirates of the Caribbean and like Jack Sparrow's accent sometimes kind of throws you out of it because it's a bit weird.
Oh, well, he's doing a Keith Richards.
Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah. It's like, what accent is that now?
It's pirate.
I don't think at any point in the film I was ever, like, it ever threw me out of the fantasy, if that makes sense, of the film.
First American actor I can recall who completely convinced me with an English-British accent, Richard Chamberlain.
Yeah.
When he was playing Hamlet.
Really?
He had never played Shakespeare, and after the huge success of Dr. Kildare in the 60s, he wanted to play Shakespeare. And God bless him, Peter Dews, who was the director of the Birmingham Repertory Company, said, okay, we'll give you the chance, and he cast him as Hamlet. And it was a wonderful production. I don't know if you remember Gemma Jones. You might remember the Duchess of Duke Street. There were other good but not starry British actors in the other parts. And Richard Chamberlain fitted in perfectly. It was a lovely production. And the following year, Chamberlain, being a Hollywood star, was not available. But the production had gone down so well that they revived it with Alec McCowan, now Sir Alec McCowan, in the lead. And the manager of the bar on the gods, the top balcony of the theatre, said to me, last year Mr. Chamberlain was good, but this man will move me. Well, I watched it, and to be honest, I didn't think that Alec McCowan was any better.
You're just about the same.
It was good. It was very good. The only really notable change, and it wasn't for any difference in quality, Ophelia, no longer played by Gemma Jones, was played by Anna Massey, who, at that time I didn't know, was then Mrs. Jeremy Brett.
Oh,
really?
And her father had played Sherlock Holmes in The Speckled Band in 1931. And her brother, obviously I didn't know, would go on to play J. Neil Gibson in Granada's Thor Bridge.
There you go, elections.
Around about 1992,
1993.
Yeah.
This is turning into 6 degrees of Kevin Payne.
Oh, yeah. It's really, isn't it? If you live in London, you're pretty much probably 1 or 2 degrees, like, from knowing someone in the Sherlock House.
Yeah.
Well, I've got 3 degrees from Kevin Bacon, which makes me very happy.
Yes.
We're all 3 degrees from Kevin Bacon.
So you two have... You guys met Jeremy, Brett, and everything, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Do you have any Brett stories?
Well, we've seen the photographs.
We have seen the photographs.
Oh, yeah.
Are
oh,
he's
yeah.
vegan, by the way?
Yes.
Yay!
You can't, though, our viewers, oh, our listeners can't see that we are eating a lot of cake. It's
just right like now. German Pfefferkuchen, which are amazing. Like, I love Jean so much buying these. I never get to eat them when Christmas. I'm in England.
I did oh, have wow. you in mind when I saw
I was going to say, thank you so much.
Well, the fact that we love Lebkuchen is neither here nor there.
Yeah.
The story of Jeremy and Dame Jean at
the
first night
photograph. The photograph that you saw upstairs. That was the opening night of The Secret of Sherlock Holmes at Wyndham's Theatre.
Okay.
Now,
it was originally them that did it, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then Edward Hardwick.
But it was written for Jeremy.
Jeremy and Edward Hardwick.
I had been in contact previously with Edward Hardwick in order to set up an interview with him, and he said, well, come backstage afterwards and we'll work out a date and time. So I was backstage, went in, had a chat with Edward, he sorted everything out for when we were going to talk, and I got lost.
And
I was carried along with this wave of people into what turned out to be Jeremy Brett's dressing room.
Oh,
where the party was going on. Now, fortunately, Michael Cox was there, and he recognized me. And I recognized Dame Jean, with whom I've been in correspondence, but that was the first time we had ever actually met.
Oh, okay.
So I introduced myself, and she immediately knew who I was. And I said to them, I don't think I'm really supposed to be here. I think it was Michael Cox who said, I don't think anybody's really going to care.
Michael is such a sweetie. He's lovely.
So I ended up at the after show party with Jeremy.
Oh, nice!
And as far as we know,
those are the only photographs of Jeremy and Dame Jean together.
Oh,
I've never seen any others elsewhere. Mm. Yeah.
It's a lovely photograph as well. He's like kneeling on the floor, kind of.
Yeah, there's a sequence of 3 or 4 like that.
You saw the small one.
Yeah.
We have the larger print, which is on the wall.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Which is signed by Jeremy.
It's signed by Jeremy, though the writing is rather faint, and it says, Special Moment.
Oh.
Jeremy Brett.
Michael Cox, by the way, for anyone among our listeners who doesn't know this, and if you don't, you should be ashamed of yourselves.
Shame on your family, shame on your cow.
the producer of the Granada Sherlock Holmes series, in which Jeremy Brett plays Sherlock Holmes, and if you have not watched it, then what are you even doing?
Shame on your family, shame on your cow.
If you have not watched
shame on you.
Why are you doing listening to this podcast? Just hop on YouTube and just watch it right now, because it's amazing.
Michael, God bless him, was one of the first non-members of the Sherlock Holmes Society, as he was in those days, who got in touch with me over the district messenger, the newsletter of the Sherlock Holmes Society. Mm-hmm. And he is a member, a long-time member now of the Society. But back in the mid-80s, he started receiving the newsletter and asking me whether the Society would be interested in things like, going along to a private preview of the Sign of Four up at the Granada Studios in Manchester.
Maybe. Let me think on that.
I'm not actually on the council these days, I said. But I will pass you over to the chairman. So that's exactly what I did, and it was between Michael and Tony Howlett, who was then the chairman, that the visit to Granada Studios was thrashed out. Michael has been a dear friend for these many years, and I have a slightly warm, comfortable feeling somewhere deep inside this huge, flabby body of mine. That I was responsible for arranging, in a very small role, helping to arrange that visit to Granada.
Which was my trip to the UK.
I was taken away.
We would all have
Jeremy
done the same if we'd been in his position.
The two of us together.
And
I didn't know it. But two of those photographs eventually ended up in TV Time.
Mm.
And someone sent me a photocopy of the pages. Mm.
Nice. Like, by the way.
And we've never been able to find a copy of the original.
No.
I didn't know. But then
Did you tell them about the documentary that we did with them?
Oh, God, no, I didn't.
Oh!
You told me when we were on a bus. Mm. So do tell it.
It was bloody blah years ago. And it was... This was done for the Biography Channel.
Yes, yeah.
And it was Sherlock Holmes, the Great Detective. There was a film... set up at the Sherlock Holmes pub in the restaurant.
Oh, nice.
With a longish table set out in front of the window in
looking into the sitting room.
Right.
The sitting room there, yes. And there were, I don't know, 8 or 10 members of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London and Dr. Watson being David Burke.
No.
Who by that time, bless him, was looking incredibly distinguished with white hair and white beard.
Wow.
The idea was that as we were filmed sitting...
Having dinner with Dr. Watson.
He would appear magically from the room behind us. That didn't quite happen. I don't think they quite got the technology, but he appeared there. He was great. His off-camera wit was the sort of thing that they would not have allowed to actually be broadcast.
Our podcast, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lovely. It's such a good time.
He was a sweetie.
Oh, wow.
So, Dr. Watson, what exactly was the relationship between Sherlock Holmes and Professor Moriarty? They were lovers. Tell me, Dr. Watson, how did you get on with Sherlock Holmes? Couldn't stand the man.
Oh, my God. Oh, bless him.
But he was absolutely charming.
Yeah.
And answering questions from the other people around the table, mostly scripted.
Well, scripted questions.
Yeah.
But I think the program itself is available on YouTube now.
Oh, nice. We'll
have to find out. It's called something like Sherlock Holmes, the Great Detective. It's the Biography Channel, anyway.
Okay.
But you will see there a sad number of...
people who are no longer with us.
Exactly.
Oh, no.
But an encouraging number of people who are, like herself and myself. And it was such fun.
Mm.
It really was.
I just love David Burke's face. Yes. He has the best facial expressions.
It's so great. Because when you guys were watching Granada, I was like, yeah, I'm going to come to Curly's house and I'm going to watch it with you. And you guys had started already with one episode. Mm-hmm. So Curly opened the door when I got in and was like, I love David Burke's face. I was like,
you traitor, you started it without me.
I think it took me about 20 seconds to like be like, David Beck, I love you.
Well, he's one of these men who gets better looking the older he gets, and you just want to slap him.
He's so distinguished, isn't he?
Yes,
he's beautifully trimmed mustache.
I completely co-signed this.
One of the best, not quite canonical, exchanges anywhere, on screen, on stage, on radio, anywhere, is in The Solitary Cyclist.
Oh, I love The Solitary Cyclist.
When Watson has told Holmes he's gone to all this effort to see what's been actually happening down there on Charlington Heath, and Holmes says, you really have done very badly. And after some very, very annoying explanations of how he could have done better, David Burks Watson says, did I really do very badly? And Jeremy says, yes.
You're so dejected.
I know, but it's so good. Beautifully put over.
Oh, it is. I'm just poor baby.
Yeah. It rips my heart out every time.
I had to adopt that for my own Sherlock Holmes play, The Great Detective, The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes.
It's a bit in the red.
So perfect.
Yeah, there's a bit in the Red-Headed League as well where they have an entire conversation just in facial expressions. It breaks down in this giggle fit.
Oh, yes. That's beautiful. Yeah. I love the whole scene where I think, what was that one we watched where there was the man who'd, assumably hung himself?
Oh.
He goes around the whole room.
Yeah, the resident patient.
And he finds all the tobacco smoke. That's brilliant. Because there's no talking to him that whole scene. It's just Jeremy Beck going around picking things up. And Lestrade looking more and more confused. And Watson looking more and more confused.
I would actually quite like to, for somebody to do that, but with on-screen text, like in the BBC.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, yes.
It's
not Lestrade, not in the resident patient.
No, is it Gregson?
No, it's not one of the regulars, one of the usual police officers, and I can't immediately remember who it is.
It's somebody different.
But it's basically Holmes assumes that everybody exists to just hold on to his stuff.
He examines every surface, and there's no talking in that whole scene.
Once, and it's 2 minutes or even longer than that.
Just nothing,
no
nothing
dialogue.
Happens.
And if Jeremy could have been able to say, don't speak. It lowers the IQ.
He absolutely would have done. I think he absolutely would have loved those lines.
Okay.
Good lines.
Very, very sad that he's no longer with us, because I think he loved
Peter
Seymour.
I think he would,
David Burke certainly does.
Apparently, Benedict Cumberbatch knew Jeremy.
Yeah, his mother was friends.
You've never yet seen, I think, Captain Kronos Vampire Hunter. Benedict's mother, Wanda Ventham, has a leading role in this, a very important role. She's not one of the three or four leads, but she is very, very important.
Wanda Ventham, IMDb, everybody.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one?